A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
I'm Norman Olney, and this is the first of KCRW's special programs on this November's election. We can't cover every issue, but tonight it's death and taxes. We'll hear the pros and cons of a measure extending taxes on the wealthiest Californians. We'll also look at one proposition that would end capital punishment and another that would make implementing it quicker and cheaper. First, let's take a look at an institution that started more than 100 years ago, direct democracy, legislation by a vote of the people. Joe Matthews is with Socolow Public Square. He's reported for the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times. His books include California Crackup, How Reform Broke the Golden State, and How We Can Fix It. Good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Warren.
Hiram Johnson, progressive, served as both governor and U.S. senator, wanted to establish the initiative process to get around private interests he thought had corrupted government 100 years ago. Has it worked out that way?
No, but it didn't work out that way even in the beginning. I mean, there's this sort of myth that we repeat over and over and over again in California that's just not supported by historical facts. You know, Johnson was new to politics when he was elected governor in 1910. He pursued this policy in his first year in office, with a host of other ballot measures, in the fall of that 1911 year, and he didn't really understand what he had done, the direct democracy component, very well. His paper suggested it had to be explained to him many times, and many of the problems that we had that are identified with it today, the influence of money, chief among them, were evident from the very beginning. I see Johnson much more of a figure. He was a very violent in rhetoric. He referred to the initiative as, his favorite metaphor was, a gun in a man's hand. And I think that's been about right. A lot of things can happen when you have a gun in your hand, and not all of them are so good.
Let me introduce Mark Baldessari. He's president and CEO of the Public Policy Institute of California. It's a nonprofit that does in-depth research on issues of all kinds, and it conducts one of our most reliable polling operations. Mark Baldessari, as always, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to hear from you, Warren.
Do the voters of California, and have they since 1910, enjoyed having a gun in their hands?
Well, we've only been conducting polling on this topic since 1998, so I can only speak for the last 18 years.
Okay.
But it's clear from all of our polling consistently that the voters really value having the initiative process as something that they can use to make public policy. They realize it has a lot of flaws attached to it. They realize the control of special interests. They complain about there being too many measures on the ballot and it's too confusing. But it's because of the lack of trust that voters have in the legislative process and the way they feel about the control of special interests on the legislative process that they want to have this checks and balance. So they realize it has flaws, but they value having that option.
But, Joe Matthews, you said this is a myth, that there aren't checks and balances.
Well, our system is very different than systems in other U.S. states and even more around the country, around the world. Direct democracy is on the rise, particularly at the local and state provincial level around the world. Both it's on the books more and it's being used more. But no one quite does it at the scale, at the expense, or I would argue it with the inflexibility. Despite a few fairly recent reforms that made things a little more flexible in our system, it's really hard to fix mistakes. We're sort of singular that I can find in being a place where the default option is with a ballot initiative of a statute, that if you make a law by initiative, you can't change it except for another vote of the people. It's a pretty brutal system when you compare it, and it makes demands of voters that I think go so far, and we're seeing it in November, that I've defended the system as something that sort of mend it, don't end it for a long time, and I you know, I look at an election like this one, and I wonder about the legitimacy of the outcomes, whether not just the measure, the number of measures themselves, but the civic and media context where, you know, there isn't a lot of great debate. Not all the measures can possibly cover, certainly not in a city like San Francisco, where people I see and Mark are, where there's not just 17 statewide initiatives, but there are 25 additional local measures on the ballot.
Okay, there are local measures on the ballot here in Southern California as well. And Mark Baldessari, back to you. You said that people really value the initiative process, even though they do recognize that it has flaws. I assume that includes some of the flaws that Joe Matthews just mentioned. But what are some examples of times when people really felt that they were making important changes in the law in California and that the process worked?
Well, you know, you'd go back several decades and you'd say the creation of the political reforms that were around the Fair Political Reforms, the FPPC and various political reforms.
1974 or so.
Yeah, or the creation of the Coastal Commission, I guess, would be you know, another example that people look back and say, well, you know, I'm proud that we did that. We might not have been, the legislature might not have gotten there. But, you know, in most cases, the voters have also told us that they'd like the legislature to get more involved in policymaking so that fewer things come to the ballot and that so hopefully some of these things could be resolved in the legislature and don't come to the voters in such large volumes and with such complexity as we see today, and then all the effects of the moneyed interests as well. The voters are not thrilled with the initiative process in terms of the way it's being practiced today, but they fear about what the consequences would be if it was just left up to the legislature and the governor.
Okay. That's all the time we have for this particular segment of our program. You've gotten us off to a great start on the initiative process, what it's about and how people feel about it. And we will continue now to look at a couple of the measures that are on the ballot this coming November. Joe Matthews, Mark Maldessari, thanks a lot for being on our show.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Now let's turn to Prop 55 on next month's ballot. It would extend for 12 years the personal income tax increases enacted temporarily 4 years ago when voters passed Proposition 30. They'd apply to single taxpayers earning over $263,000 a year and to joint taxpayers earning more than $526,000. These have been adjusted for inflation. One of those signing the ballot arguments in favor of Prop 55 is California's elected Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tom Torlakson. Good to have you on our show.
Great to be with you, Warren.
Why do we need to do this? This was a tax increase. The promise was it would come to an end.
Well, part of it came to an end, the part that affects most Californians. The real intent is we need to finance our schools, invest in our schools. Our students are entering a fierce global competition in the global economy, and we need to be equipped. We're one of the lowest funded school systems in the country. We need to come up to where California has been in the past. We're able to bring back art, music, drama, vocational education, career education, science and civics, smaller class sizes. These are reasons why, after the recession, devastated school budgets, Prop 30 came into effect. And now we have a new measure, essentially. It is continuing part of the old Prop 30, but sunsetting the part that affects most Californians. So no one will pay more taxes as a consequence of this ballot measure 55.
Let me introduce one of the opponents signing the ballot measures against Prop 55, John Kupal. He's president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayer Association, has a membership of more than 200,000 people. Good to have you on our program.
It's a pleasure to be here, Warren.
What do you say? Not a tax increase, according to Tom Torlakson, and providing money that we much need for schools.
Well, first of all, the official budget estimates from the legislative analysts show that higher taxes are not needed to balance the budget and fully fund schools in California. Since 2012, when we were, and I would agree with the superintendent that in 2012 we were in a state of crisis, but since that point in time, we now have a 52% increase in school funding. Again, the LAO, not just conservatives, believe that education can be fully funded by letting this tax expire, and the economic consequences of this particular tax And I would agree that most people don't have to pay it because it is a tax on high-wealth individuals. But we have already begun to see significant capital flight out of the state of California, and it's very troubling for the long-term prospects of the economic health of California. We need structural tax reform, but the tax revenue in California is already highly volatile, overly reliant on high-wealth individuals, and as the governor himself has acknowledged, that's a real problem, and Prop 55 just makes that worse.
Tom Tarleton, back to you. The Legislative Analyst's Office, cited by Mr. Kupal, says we don't need this in order to keep the schools going. How do you respond to what he said and also the concern that taxpayers who might have to pay these taxes are going to leave the state?
Well, I'm not so worried about that. I think it's more important to invest in our economy by having a well-trained workforce, and that whole movement towards career education is helping us do that. That is the direction California is heading. We talk to any superintendent, any school board member in the state, and they need money. We're not back to where we were in 2008. The budgets are still struggling in many regards, and to be 45th in the nation in per pupil spending is not where California, the great state of California, should be. We should invest, like we did in the 70s and the 1980s, in a strong public education system that prepares our young people for careers in college and a competitive economy.
Would this money be earmarked for the things that you mentioned, for more art, more music, more career education, vocational training?
It won't be specifically earmarked because we have a new funding system that distributes the money to local school districts and give the elected local board members in districts the ability to prioritize what makes sense for their community, their taxpayers, their priorities. So this is a real positive change that has occurred since the original Prop 30. This gives local entities, local school districts, the power to set priorities with their parents, with their business community, with their teachers and other community leaders.
John Kupal, back to you. Does that make it easy for you to go along with this, or would it make it easier for you to go along with this, particularly since the superintendent says we're actually not back to where we were in 2008?
No, obviously the amount of per pupil spending in the state of California is subject to such wide variations in claims. It's much closer to average. But I would say that per pupil spending is not indicative of the quality of the educational product we get. There are other states that spend far less per student and yet have a far better educational product. I would say that there are significant issues with the amount of money we're spending on education and the notion that it's going to be going into the classroom and into arts and science and vocational ed. Let's make one thing very clear. Californians will be facing a host of tax increases, both at the state and local level, and the lion's share of those dollars will be going for that 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is unfunded pension obligations. The state teacher retirement system is woefully underfunded, and those are obligations we have to meet, but that is where most of the proposed tax revenue, both for this particular proposal and a lot of the local ones as well, will be going because of California's horrific crisis with unfunded pension obligations.
Superintendent Tarleton, what about the argument that other places get more for less and that per pupil spending isn't what we ought to be focused on?
Well, per pupil spending is just one indicator. The good news is we are transforming education, and the rest of the nation is looking at California moving into the lead. We're doing more critical thinking, problem solving, teamwork, writing skills, rather than multiple choice in the old-fashioned multiple choice paper tests. So we are moving ahead. A Stanford study said that we are way behind, like $20 billion a year behind what is a comparable investment in other states. You know, we do have a high cost of living. We do have 25% of our children growing up in poverty. Almost a third of our children are English learners. So we have extra challenges that other states have, not in the same degree, but we are addressing it through real education transformation, bringing technology into the schools, bringing computers, bringing digital learning. This is all part of this new era of wise investment of those dollars, stretching every dollar to make it work.
Do you agree that the teacher retirement system is, in fact, inflated and that teachers here are getting too much and that governments are going to go broke as a result?
I don't believe our teachers are getting too much. A typical teacher may retire with an income of $36,000 a year. Medical costs they have to bear on their own in retirement that might be $500 to $700 a month. You know, teachers are, they don't go in the profession to get rich. They go in the profession because they love kids. So I disagree with that. I think the reform that was recently championed by the governor, where the legislature put up more money, each teacher has to put up more money towards their pension system, and the school districts have to put up more money. That's the reform that is addressing the needs of the STRS system.
John Kupal, what about the large number, large percentage of children in poverty and also English language learners that we have in California? Certainly those things increase the challenges and very much might increase the costs as well. Is that something we ought to be taking into consideration?
I think so. I would agree with the superintendent that California definitely has some demographic challenges that other states don't have, and I think that does need to be considered. However, I also think that we need to consider some of the educational reforms that those of us who are like education but want some of the reforms, we need to press forward. Teacher tenure right now, when there are layoffs, some of the best teachers get laid off because they don't have seniority. Teacher tenure rules. The ability to fire teachers who abuse children. In the LA Unified School District, they have dozens of teachers who they have warehoused in what they call rubber rooms, and they continue to pay them. And that's a drain on valuable educational dollars. Also, charter schools have proven to be very cost-effective and do a very good job of educating kids, but unfortunately, the existing bureaucracy and the unions fight school choice, either in terms of vouchers. Of course, vouchers are off the table in California, but at least charter schools, there ought to be an expansion. But in LA in particular, for example, there is an outright war on charter schools.
Is that a question of money, though?
Well, they get more bang for the buck. I mean, the charter schools have proven to be far more cost-effective in the use of educational dollars, okay. And that's the kind of thing we ought to be pursuing.
All right. We have a clock running, and as we get it, we now have equality achieved on both sides, even though we haven't gotten into all of the issues involved. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Superintendent Tom Tarlickson for Prop 55, John Kupal opposed. Thanks to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break and come back with two measures dealing with capital punishment in California. This is a KCRW special report on this year's ballot measures. I'm Armin Alney.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
Warren Olney back with KCRW's first special report on this year's election, focusing on state ballot initiatives. There are two measures dealing with the death penalty in this state. Prop 62 would replace it with life without the possibility of parole. Prop 66 would retain it with the goal of making implementation quicker and easier. Whichever one gets the most votes will go into effect. We'll start with Prop 62 and Mike Farrell, who's a veteran actor, best known for the long-running TV series MASH. More to the point, he's a political activist and a leading voice against capital punishment. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much, Warren. Nice to be with you, and thank you for this time.
Why should the voters abolish the death penalty?
Well, it doesn't serve us. The death system in our state is broken. The death penalty across the country is suffering, obviously, from the grave number of injustices and problems associated with it. But here in California, we have the largest death row in the country, 25% of the death row inmates in the entire nation. The system simply is not working. It is biased. It's racist in application. It's biased against, primarily used against the poor and the poorly defended. It entraps and kills innocent people. And it is costing us a huge amount of money. Proposition 62 will simply do away with the death penalty, provide the ultimate sanction as life in prison without the possibility of parole, require that the inmates work and provide restitution to victims or a victim's family fund, and will save taxpayers, according to the legislative analyst, $150 million every year.
Once again, Prop 62 would abolish the death penalty, as Mike Farrell has explained. Prop 66 is designed to retain it and to respond to the arguments we've heard for abolition. Michelle Hennessy is president of the Association of Deputy District Attorneys in Los Angeles County. She is against Prop 62 and in favor of Prop 66. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Warren.
Why do we want Prop 66? Why is it better than what we just heard described?
Well, the only thing I agree with from Mr. Farrell is that the death penalty system is broken. I find the rest to be politically motivated hyperbole to justify a position. The fact of the matter is the system can be fixed and it works in other states, and Prop 66 is designed to fix it. And one of the key factors, in fact, does not eliminate due process but increases due process by allowing condemned inmates to have an attorney immediately appointed, whereas now there is an average 5-year wait for appellate counsel and 13-year wait for habeas counsel. And that is decades of wait where absolutely nothing is happening. No one's working on these inmates' appeals. And if we just fix that single problem, that just about cuts the appeals time in half. And they're deprived of absolutely nothing. And the money to pay for those extra attorneys comes from rehousing these inmates anywhere in the Department of Corrections system, which the Legislative Analyst Office has estimated will save tens of millions of dollars annually.
So you would keep capital punishment but do away with death row?
Correct. San Quentin is a terribly expensive, archaic prison. And if you allow the Department of Corrections to house some of these inmates in general population or in other more efficient prisons, that saves tens of millions of dollars annually.
Mike Farrell, back to you. At what point have we demonstrated that in California, innocent people have, in fact, been executed because of the way this system works?
What we know in California is that, the Los Angeles Times raised the question of Thomas Thompson. It's a case that has been bandied about for many years, but it's very clear to those of us who look at the case that there was no full adjudication of his case. He was executed because of a glitch in the Supreme Court, and he's dead now. But what we do have are 68 men, mostly men and women, who have been charged with murder. In some cases, the attorneys tried to get, prosecutors tried to get them to death row. But 68 of them have been convicted of murder and returned, ultimately exonerated and freed. A number of them were sent to death to life in prison, and three of them, or four, it's a little unclear about one, were sent to death row. So what we've done, what we know, is that we've incarcerated and for many, many years punished people who were not guilty for crimes that they were convicted of having committed, which they had not committed. We don't know how many may have been innocent that we have executed. Fortunately, because we've, in the system as it now exists, we've, since 1978, we've condemned over 1,000 men and women and executed 13. That's one of the demonstrations of how ill-suited the system is to
Okay, let me go back to the Assistant District Attorney in Los Angeles County, Michelle Hennessy. If, in fact, even one person has been executed when that person was innocent, or if, once again, 68 people were exonerated because their convictions didn't hold up, doesn't that suggest that we might, in fact, be killing innocent people? Is that justifiable?
It would suggest that if it were true, but it's political hyperbole. No innocent person has been executed in the current system. Even the governor has said so. And getting a sentence overturned on a technicality, which is the cases Mr. Farrell talks about, and not being able to successfully retry them 20 years later is not the same as a finding of factual innocence. No one on California's current death row who's been sentenced there under the current system has ever been found factually innocent afterwards.
Mike Farrell, what do you say to that?
I'm sorry what she's saying. I resent it being categorized as hyperbole. What she's saying is simply not true. The people who have been exonerated are demonstrated to have been wrongfully convicted innocent and released because of their innocence. To claim that they are released on a technicality is simply false. And to claim that the system, the problem is the system doesn't want to admit. There is a kind of institutional imperative to not admit that innocent people were incarcerated, let alone executed. But Those are facts. These are facts that are readily available to anybody who wants to look at them.
Ms. Hennessey, why would we be better off without the death penalty? What's wrong with life without the possibility of parole? What would we lose if we weren't executing people?
We lose true justice for the most heinous murderers in our society. The people on death row are not average murderers for the most part. These are not liquor store robberies gone bad. These are individuals like Charles Ng, who kidnapped, tortured, and murdered entire families. People like Lawrence Bittaker, the toolbox killer, who kidnapped, tortured, raped, and murdered five teenage girls. These are individuals who rape and torture children and then kill them. These are the worst of the worst. And it includes people who were already convicted of murder and then either got out and committed murder again or executed murders from death row or from state prison or killed prison guards or other inmates. What do you get if you're already serving a life sentence and you kill someone else? The answer should not be nothing.
What about that, Mr. Farrell?
Well, clearly we have. There are such things as degrees of incarceration. And if somebody proves himself or herself to be so sick that they are in danger of killing somebody else while in prison for life without parole, that person, as we well know, can be put in a position where he or she does not have human contact. So, you know, trotting out this the bloody shirt, as prosecutors tend to do, and wave it for everybody by naming three or four or five cases of really, truly sick people who deserve to have themselves incarcerated absolutely for the rest of their lives and deserve, hopefully, to have treatment of the whatever it is that has created this aberration in their behavior. But the idea that the 747 people on death row in California are all such individuals is absolutely insane.
Ms. Hennessey, excuse me for interrupting Mr. Farrell, but you have said Mr. Farrell's engaged in political hyperbole, but district attorneys are elected and they are political figures. And don't they want to go before the voters and say they're being tough on crime, therefore they support the death penalty?
Prosecutors, above all other things, are supposed to be just and measured in the punishment they seek. My office has one of the most detailed and fair analyses of when to seek death with input from the defense. So this is not a rash decision made to get votes. It's a very serious decision, and everyone takes it very seriously.
And what about the people, once again, that Mr. Farrell talks about who have been exonerated? You said those were all cases involving technicalities, but if, in fact, they're not, if one person, one innocent person were killed because we have the death penalty, would that then make it necessary to throw it out?
Well, if there wasn't a death penalty, that innocent, allegedly innocent person would still be incarcerated for life without parole, so that wouldn't be fair either. I think the very best thing you can do is get them a lawyer sooner instead of the way they have it now, making them wait 5 to 10 years just to get a lawyer. If they have an actual claim of innocence, for God's sakes, get them a lawyer sooner so that can be heard.
Okay. Once again, this was on the ballot 4 years ago. It failed. We'll see what happens this time. Mike Farrell, who favors Prop 562, L.A. Deputy District Attorney Michelle Hennessey, who favors Prop 66. One would eliminate the death penalty. The other would maintain it. Thanks so much. Good to have you both on our program.
Thank you.
Thanks, Warren.
This KCRW election special was produced by Jennifer Wolf. Sonia Geis is our managing editor. I'm Warren Olney. At 7 in the evening next Friday, we'll be going in-depth on the propositions to legalize recreational marijuana use and set the rules for bilingual education. Thanks for joining.